How stupid I can do? I be scared when anybody open fire.
Well, it was completely by accident that I ended up getting in touch with mercenaries in West Africa.
The story I'm about to tell you is insane.
I suppose the one very obvious question that no one ever asked at any time was what could possibly go wrong.
It's a story about mercenaries. A story about a failed plot to overthrow a murderous dictator. A story about a fake rebel group. And a story about what people are willing to do for money, for greed, for power, or for good footage. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light into the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world.
My name is James Brabazon, and I'm the author of My Friend the Mercenary.
James is a big guy, 6'4", 210 pounds, with a full dark beard. Think of a rugby player. The kind of guy you can imagine holding his own if he ends up in a tough spot. And that's the thing about James. He spent a lot of his life not just ending up in tough spots, but seeking them out.
The phrase young and naive reporter is going to crop up quite a lot. And I really was. The pressures that freelancers are under to get a story. There was a point at which in West Africa, I would have done anything for a scoop to A, keep my career going and B, pay the mortgage.
About 20 years ago, James knew that there was a big scoop to be had in Liberia, in West Africa. There were reports of a brutal civil war, a conflict that defied description in all of its horrors. So rather than try to describe it, James thought it would be good to film it. But there was a reason that nobody had yet. It was too dangerous. So to try to protect himself while he went off to film in a war zone, James got in touch with a mercenary named Cobus Clausens.
Cobus was very proud to be called a mercenary. Others were much more circumspect about it. Cobus introduced me to a South African former soldier who'd been a lieutenant colonel in 5 Recce, which is an apartheid era special forces unit. And I'd gone in to Liberia with this former lieutenant colonel, a man called Nick Detoy, and he'd gone in as my sort of bodyguard, medic, run logistics for me, and I'd gone in with a camera crew as well.
Nick was a mercenary, a gun for hire.
So a mercenary is somebody who fights for money in the army or in the military of a state that isn't their own state.
That's Sarah.
I'm Sarah Percy, and I'm an associate professor of international relations at the University of Queensland.
Sarah is also one of the world's foremost experts on mercenaries. She's going to help us make sense of what happened to James and how it fits into the broader pattern of what mercenaries are, how they operate, and why we might be concerned about their return to prominence in conflicts.
So it's a really old idea, the idea that you have people who fight for money rather than any kind of national attachment. And sometimes people call them the world's second oldest profession as a result.
Back in Liberia, 20 years ago, Nick Detoy, the mercenary, had been at it for a while too. He was a seasoned combat veteran, though much of that experience was as a special forces commando with South Africa's apartheid regime.
And this is at the period where I was beginning to learn about who he was and the exploits that Nick had got up to in the South African military and special forces, some of which were not savoury. I should say at this point, I've been brought up to sort of regard the apartheid era military in South Africa as being sort of morally akin to the Waffen SS.
But James needed a guy who could help keep him safe. Nick was that guy. So they set off, hopelessly unprepared for what they were about to encounter.
I'd seen a bit of war. I'd seen different conflicts. I hadn't seen anything like Liberia. And I haven't since, to be honest. Yeah, I was 30 years old. And the other important thing about speaking personally for a moment about it, was that I'd never made a film before. And when my cameraman left, because they were on a very short contract and we'd been extremely naive in how long we thought this would take us, he left me with a very small video camera, a box of tapes, a couple of spare batteries, and the instruction manual for the camera. I said, there you go, good luck. Nick and I were left there in the jungle together. We were embedded with the rebel troops of the LURD, the LURD, who were fighting against Charles Taylor's army.
But much of the time, getting good footage conflicted with another key ambition that James and Nick had: to stay alive. And in that regard, Nick earned his pay.
I mean, I say he saved my life. I mean, he directly intervened and saved my life physically. There were firefights in the town where we were. We were surrounded on three sides by the government army. And we usually attack first thing in the morning and last thing in late in the afternoon. And on one occasion, we'd spent about 2.5 hours getting to a forward firing position. I'd done quite a lot of that crawling on my stomach with him under quite heavy machine gun fire. We finally got to a place where we could stand up, get round the side of a building, and I could actually film oncoming government troops. And you could see them very clearly in the tree line. They were very close, I'd say at this point, probably about 50 yards away. Nick looked at me and said, you know, we need to leave now. I refused. I said, no, we've spent hours getting here. I need to film something. He said, no, we need to leave now. They'd run out. The rebels had run out of RPG grenades, rocket-propelled grenades. And without those, their morale collapses very quickly, and he feared that they would retreat and be overrun. He insisted that we fall back to a different position. As we did so, the government troops in the tree line fired a rocket-propelled grenade at us. He physically grabbed me, pulled me out of the way, and we rolled over on the ground. That rocket-propelled grenade then travelled on and hit a group of NCOs and commanders standing a ways behind us. We then stood up again. We took some fairly accurate rifle fire at that point, at which point he spanned me around, pushed me in the small of my back and shoved me down the road till we got round the corner of the building, and then we scuttled off back to where we'd been staying. And, actually, that day had resulted in the partial overrun of the town by government forces.
That was only one of the many occasions in which Nick saved James's life.
There were lots of other incidents as well where he'd physically hold me back. We were ambushed on a road. Finally, the town had been overrun. We retreated about 300 miles through dense primary jungle. And I'd got too far forward at one point. He physically held me back. We were ambushed almost immediately. Very heavy machine gun fire from both sides that claimed the number of casualties. I mean, he was essentially a sort of guardian angel that looks after me.
And under that intense pressure, Nick and James, the mercenary and the filmmaker, became close.
Conflict is like a moral pressure cooker. Friendships that would normally be born out of, you know, months or years of familiarity, if they're ever born at all, can solidify very quickly within days or weeks in the pressure cooker of war. And that is certainly what happened to us.
Despite many, many close calls, Nick and James managed to survive. Their films about the Liberian Civil War and the atrocities committed during it shocked the world. And while their risk-taking might seem reckless to some, it's undeniable that their reporting and the videos that they risked their lives to get dramatically increased international attention on one of the worst and most brutal conflicts in history, a conflict that was being ignored. And it would never have been possible without Nick, a gun for hire. And when the filming was done and the contract was over, James started searching for his next project. And that's when Nick brought him an idea.
We were having a drink in a hotel bar in Guinea-Conakry. And Nick told me that he'd been contacted by a consortium of businessmen, some of whom he knew, some of whom he didn't, to put together a military plan for a mercenary-led seizure of power in a country just up the coast. And there aren't very many candidates for where that could have been. And he asked me whether or not I would like to film it. And at first that was couched in terms of, we're mates, we've been working in West Africa in the thick of it for ages. He trusted me, I trusted him. Did I want to do it?
That was Nick's proposal, to film a mercenary-led coup d'etat.
I don't think anyone's actually ever filmed a mercenary seizure of power from the inside. It seemed like an extraordinary coup. I knew what Nick's background was, so it seemed to me that if Nick was involved, it looked like it might succeed. So my gut reaction was to say yes. If you say yes, you can then work out later on if you really want to say yes or no.
But if James was going to get involved, he needed to meet the man behind the coup plot, and that wasn't Nick.
And all the time, there was referenced important people behind the scenes, money men behind the scenes, and an ongoing conversation that Nick was having with someone who was running the show that he hoped very much that I would meet in the near future. And eventually I did meet that person, and that was Simon Mann.
All right, let's meet Simon Mann.
Okay, so, yeah, I'm Simon Mann. I'm 67 years old. I'm a UK citizen with a South African passport as well. For much of my life, I've been a soldier of one sort or another, firstly with the British Army, and then I was one of the people who was there at the beginning of Executive Outcomes.
Executive Outcomes was a mercenary army, and Simon was a key player in it. It was organized and run by a series of ex-South African apartheid-era special forces guys. But a big chunk of the soldiers in it were Namibians and Angolans. Their clients included the governments of Angola and Sierra Leone, along with companies like Texaco, De Beers, and Chevron. And while they were never far from controversy, they were notoriously effective on the battlefield. If you've ever seen the Leonardo DiCaprio film Blood Diamond, Executive Outcomes are the mercenaries depicted in the film who swoop in with superior firepower to defeat the RUF, a horrifically brutal rebel force operating in West Africa.
I think we did absolutely the right thing at the right time and in the right way. No one's ever accused us of war crimes or excessive use of force or anything like that. And we stopped RUF.
We're going to get back to James and Simon's story in a moment, and the coup plot that they would later try to execute in West Africa. But first, we should put Executive Outcomes and Simon's work into its proper context. And to do that, we need to take a step back and learn a bit more about the history of mercenaries. Why they exist, how they operate, and how they've changed over time. Here's Sarah again.
Well, we have mercenaries pretty much for as long as we've known about war. So there are mercenaries in ancient Greece and Rome, and certainly by the time that European warfare starts to become recorded, there are mercenaries.
And they came into existence because ancient leaders had to solve a key problem. How to fight when you didn't have an army that was very good, and would likely lose if it was put to the ultimate test.
Armies were not reliable. So if you had to raise an army, say in the 14th century, you were probably a feudal lord, and you'd have to call on people's feudal obligations that they owed to you as a lord to get them to fight. And that entailed getting people who were basically peasants to pick up arms and fight for you. Now, some of those people would have been good, but most of those people would have been rubbish. So this is where mercenaries come in as a supplement. And they are battle-hardened, they are experienced, and therefore they're actually really useful because they have a lot more experience and a lot more fighting equipment than sort of an everyday person would.
And also, and this is a key detail, they had skills that other soldiers simply didn't have.
And then they began to specialize in particular types of fighting. So mercenaries get very well known for fighting with the pike, which is a common feature of medieval warfare, but requires a certain degree of skill that most people didn't have. And you see that all the way through the history of mercenaries, that what they tend to do is develop an expertise in a particular technology or a way of fighting war that makes them quite valuable on the market.
These days, Sarah says that the modern version of the pike for mercenaries is the helicopter.
Particularly for the more dodgy end of contracting, having a helicopter in conflicts in lots of parts of the world confers a really big military advantage. So there's a lot of helicopter pilots out there whose services are highly valued.
But whether it's pikes or helicopters, mercenaries haven't just come with special skills. They've also come with moral baggage, and a sort of skepticism that people who fight for money aren't in warfare for the right reasons.
But there's a long-standing discomfort with the idea that if you're going to engage in battle, you need to be doing it for some sort of higher purpose, because we don't like the idea of people who kill people for money. We like to dress that up in, we're soldiers because we fight and die for the country. We're soldiers because we're fighting and dying for the king. However you want to dress it up, the issue that mercenaries have had historically is that they can't dress it up in that way. So as long as we've had mercenaries, we've had objections to mercenaries.
Over time, those objections faded because mercenary armies faded.
The difference is that as the state got more and more organized and more capable of raising a standing army, they needed to rely on mercenaries less and less. And as soon as it became possible to stop using mercenaries, largely states did. So we have this stretch of time where mercenaries largely disappear from world history, from about the 1860s to about the 1960s.
But of course, to explain people like Simon Mann or Nick Dutoit, mercenaries needed to make a comeback, and they did.
From the late 1990s onwards, we definitely have this rise in companies that people, names would recognize, like Blackwater or Executive Outcomes or some of these companies which received a lot of press attention. So I think why you have that rise is because you have a push to privatization in most Western governments, which begins to happen through the late 80s and 90s anyway. And if you're privatizing various government services, I think for a lot of governments, it was sort of like, well, we might as well privatize military stuff to a degree as well.
The war in Iraq also bolstered mercenary armies, because the U.S. ended up in a conflict that lasted much longer than it anticipated. And the American government decided to augment its forces with private contractors. But where did all those people come from? Who becomes a mercenary? It's important to keep in mind that mercenary armies are largely like normal companies in the sense that they effectively have their own version of an HR department. You need to recruit soldiers if you're going to have enough people to get the job done. And Sarah says that modern mercenary armies recruit two types of people mainly.
And the first category is people who retire from the regular military and want to make some extra money. And you saw this quite a lot in Iraq. A lot of the people I spoke to in the British Army would joke with me that if you were a senior non-commissioned officer in the Marines in the UK, you used to retire and go open a pub. And in 2003, 2004, 2005, you would retire and go do a couple of tours of duty as a contractor in Iraq and then go open your pub. But I think the other type is there is definitely a type of soldier that cannot adjust to living in civilian life. And you see this quite a lot, that there are people who, for whatever reason, cannot live in a regular society. And so they continue being mercenaries because it's a way to keep fighting and they don't really know how to do anything else. And that's actually surprisingly common.
We're going to come back to the bigger picture of mercenaries a bit later on. But let's get back to Simon Mann. Because in 2004, Simon was busy plotting a mercenary-led coup to topple one of the world's worst dictators, President Obiang of Equatorial Guinea.
And so I was expecting that I would get off the plane wearing a suit and be shaking hands, not a combat suit and shooting. That was the idea.
The plot that Simon was hatching would eventually become known as the Wanga coup. Here's James again.
The Wanga coup is named after the British slang word for money, which is wonga. And it's a sort of informal, quite funny term for money, which you very rarely hear anymore. And how would you describe the Wanga coup? I mean, the short answer would be an utterly devastating exercise in hubris and misinformation. I mean, that would be being generous. Frankly, it was an attempt. An attempted coup is normally how it's reported. It was such an absolute impossibility that it could ever have succeeded that I think attempt is imbuing it with a sense of dignity and possibility that simply didn't exist.
But it didn't always seem completely implausible. And there were arguments to be made that regime change might not be such a bad thing in Equatorial Guinea.
It's a former Spanish colony. It's comprised of two parts. There's a continental part in mainland Africa, which is just north of Gabon. And there is an island called Bioko, which is where the main center of power rests. And it's ruled by a dictator called President Teodoro Obiang, who is still in power.
I had very good information that President Obiang was a terrible, terrible tyrant.
His rule has been characterized as one of ruthlessness, oppression, eradication of press freedom. It's an absolute dictatorship, which is absolutely awful.
But before James could be brought on board to film the coup attempt, Simon had to know that he could be trusted. And that required a face-to-face meeting, brokered by Nick Dutoit, the mercenary that James had worked with earlier in Liberia.
Well, meeting Simon Mann was a very strange experience because I flew into Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris, in France, met with Nick, and we drove to a restaurant which was very near the airport. You know when you fly into airports and you see those tiny villages that are somehow still exist, stranded on the outside of the wire, and you think, whatever happens there? I mean, you know, how do you live with, you know, thousands of 747s coming over? Well, then we went to one of these villages and there was a little bistro, bar, restaurant place, which is actually very nice. We went there and we had dinner and spoke almost entirely in euphemisms. I knew what he was doing. He knew why I was there. He knew what my relationship with Nick was. Nick had briefed me on the way in not to ask any direct, geographically specific questions.
As the dinner came to a close, there was reason to believe that all the secrecy, all the coded language, was justified.
And we drank rather a lot of wine, and we had rather a lot of Armagnac afterwards, and it was all quite good fun. And as we were leaving, a Frenchman accosted me at the doorway of the restaurant as we were leaving and said to me, in English, "I know who you are and I know what you're doing." And Simon and I looked at each other and walked out into the night, and we'd called a taxi. And he looked at me and said, "Who was that?" And I said, "I don't know, maybe it was DGSE, French Secret Service. Or maybe it was just a random drunk. I don't know."
But even after that harrowing, bewildering event, Simon was sold on James. And his role in the coup plot became clear. He wasn't just going to film it for a documentary. He was going to film it for propaganda, to try to create the illusion of legitimacy. And that required creating the impression that it was a homegrown plot, with a local president installed by local troops, rather than a government being toppled by a foreign mercenary army.
There was to be a palace coup immediately prior to our arrival. I mean, we didn't think we could just roll up with 60 people, 70 people, and take over a country. The idea was that that night, the president would have been arrested in bed, and we would therefore arrive as basically the escort to the guy who was going to run the interim government.
What they wanted me to do, essentially, was be a propagandist. So they wanted me to film the newly arrived president surrounded by black African mercenaries who would be dressed in local dress, and it would be important for me to film them so that it couldn't be heard what they were saying, because they would probably speak a different language. So it would look like the victorious president had been installed by Equato Guineans and not a foreign force.
As you might expect, James had misgivings about that, because he was a filmmaker, not a propagandist. But he was nonetheless torn.
What was being suggested was a violent upheaval that would affect the lives of tens, hundreds of thousands of people, and by extension, possibly millions of people, by affecting a regional balance of power. I could say no, and no one would have understood what the internal dynamics of that operation were from the outside. It wasn't as if there was a queue of journalists waiting to get in and I happened to be the one at the front of it. It was just me. If I agreed to go along with it, I'd have a ringside seat. I would see who the players were, what was happening, and there would come a point at which I could decide whether I wanted to be a part of it or whether I wanted to report it or whatever. But it seemed to me that it was a very important story that no one else was going to tell, and I wouldn't be able to tell it if I said no.
Of course, the rub was how to actually make the coup happen, how to make sure that the president got arrested in bed, that the soldiers were dressed up to look like locals, and that the film was rolling while it all went down. But it turns out that overthrowing a government, even a weak government like the one in Equatorial Guinea, is easier said than done.
Now, the plans changed and morphed rapidly. It went from seaborne invasion to heliborne invasion to aerial invasion. I mean, you name it, it went through these different plans.
Things began to unwind very badly. We were very short of money. We were running out of time.
I mean, it all just sounded too good to be true. And therein, a lesson, when something sounds too good to be true, that's because it is.
There were various plans, but the one that they finally decided on was this. For logistical reasons, they would fly in multiple planes, some carrying troops, some carrying weapons, and they would converge at a rendezvous point on an airstrip. Once the weapons and the mercenaries were in the same spot, they'd move on to another plane, and that plane would fly into an airstrip in Equatorial Guinea, where they'd launch the coup.
Sounds good, except for the fact that, first of all, the airstrip in question was in a very unstable area.
They needed someone, or many someones, to secure the airstrip so that they wouldn't get arrested right away when they arrived.
And Nick had made contact with a so-called rebel group in that area who, in return for money and weapons, were going to seize the airstrip and take control of it. Therefore, there would be a safe landing space for the mercenaries and the weapons.
Doesn't seem like a bad idea. There was only one small problem. A minor detail, really.
That rebel group doesn't exist. They are complete and absolute fantasy conjured out of the imagination of a Congolese con artist. So that was a joke. Had they attempted to land, the airstrip would not have been in rebel hands and they would immediately have been arrested, or worse.
But even if the rebel group had existed, and even if they had secured the airstrip, there was an even more fundamental problem, which was uncovered when the mercenaries sent a reconnaissance team to check out the airstrip.
And his report was that the runway was just too short. You couldn't actually physically land the Ilyushin and the Antonov that they needed to bring in the weapons and carry the people at that airport.
You might think that these sort of substantial setbacks would be enough to stop the coup plotters from going ahead with the plan. But you'd be wrong.
I mean, there were members on the ground saying to Simon, is this really okay? Are we okay? And he was repeatedly telling people that they had a green light.
And where I made a mistake was to think that I could sort of keep going and just sort of do it by a wing and a prayer.
From then onwards, there was a mad dash scramble to get the coup relaunched again. In the process, all caution went to the wind. People were told about the plan who should never have been told about it. The whole thing was as leaky as a sieve.
And that led to our failure.
Despite those leaks, despite the disastrous planning, despite the entire plot relying on, as Simon put it, a wing and a prayer, they decided to go for it anyway. But for personal reasons, James wasn't there when the plot was launched.
My grandfather died right at the moment that the coup was supposed to launch. I was with my family.
But as he's thousands of miles away back in the UK mourning, Simon and the other mercenaries hop on a plane, hoping to beat the odds.
The 727 takes off from South Africa, lands in Zimbabwe in Harare, is boarded by Zimbabwean officials. Everyone on board is arrested.
I was arrested in Zimbabwe on my way to Equatorial Guinea.
In case you're wondering, getting arrested in Zimbabwe on suspicion of plotting a coup in Equatorial Guinea isn't exactly a fun moment.
So my arrest there in Zimbabwe was obviously a terrifying moment because, you know, I knew what the Zimbabweans were not exactly going to regard me as a very sort of popular person, to say the least. And so, you know, that was pretty scary. I was mistreated, beaten up, shoved around different police holding tanks, and I knew that I wasn't, you know, I hadn't been formally arrested, and I knew that nobody knew where I was, so I could quite easily be chopped up and fed to the crocodiles. That would be that, you know. So that was pretty frightening.
James's mercenary friend, Nick Dutoit, was also arrested, but not in Zimbabwe.
Nick and his colleagues are rolled up in Equatorial Guinea. Separately, they've already gone up there as the advance guard to set up cover businesses and a reconnaissance operation months beforehand.
And that left James, back in London, unaware of what had just happened, mourning his grandfather's death.
And when I emerged from that and went back to London, I switched the radio on and heard a report that a plane load of suspected mercenaries had been arrested. I tried to call Nick. No response, none of the numbers for anyone I had worked. I called his wife. She was in distress. She's still denying everything at that point. I hung up, and then every intelligence agency from Western Europe and America called me.
It turned out that James had made a lucky escape, but it was due to events out of his control rather than his own choices.
I fundamentally didn't participate in the coup insofar as I didn't get my boots on the ground and I didn't go to jail as a result.
If he had gotten onto that airplane, James would almost certainly have ended up in the same position as Nick.
And he did 5 years and 8 months in Black Beach prison. A lot of that time he was shackled hand and foot. For the beginning of it, he was kept in solitary confinement in the dark. The hand shackles were eventually removed. His leg irons were kept on until just before he was released. You know, he had sores that cut down to the bone. He lost a crazy percentage of his body weight. You could argue whether he deserved that or not. Did he pay the price? Absolutely.
Simon started off in prison in Zimbabwe, but was eventually moved to Equatorial Guinea.
I was kidnapped in the middle of the night out of Chikurubi Maximum Security in Zim. And then over the course of 3 days, they smuggled me to Equatorial Guinea. I knew what was happening, and I had been warned by friends and enemies alike that if they got hold of me in Equatorial Guinea, that would be the end of that. And so when I walked down the steps of the aeroplane on arrival in Malibu, not the way I'd expected to arrive in Malibu, but in handcuffs and leg irons, I honestly thought that the moment I stepped foot on Equatorial Guinea soil, someone's just going to walk forward with a 9mm and put a bullet through me. That was quite a crisis, shall we say, coming down the steps wondering if that was going to happen.
Thankfully for Simon, that didn't happen.
Well, this guy called General Manuel, wearing a suit, walked up to me as I stepped onto Equatorial Guinea soil and said, Mr. Man, don't worry. If you help us, we'll do our best to help you. Please get into the back of that Toyota. So I thought, oh, okay. That's nice. So I got into the back of the Toyota, and sure enough, a week later, my interrogation started.
The interrogation aimed to get Simon to spill the beans about who in Equatorial Guinea was working with the mercenaries.
They are not stupid. And they had worked out that there would have been a palace coup immediately prior to our arrival. And like any organization, what they really wanted to know was who were the traitors inside. Because obviously, a palace coup always involves traitors very close to the throne, so to speak. And what they really wanted to know was the identity of those individuals, which I didn't know, because the people above me in the chain of command, hadn't told me, for obvious reasons. So I didn't know who those people were.
As Simon tells it, at least, he tried to puzzle it out with his interrogators, trying to figure out who might have been involved on the inside of the regime. Because Simon figured that was his only shot of getting out of prison.
We carried out our own investigation because I was sure that the people I'd been working with must have made mistakes. There must be clues in what happened that would point to how we could find out the identification of these people. And we worked on that, and we did get somewhere. We got somebody else in, got them interrogated as well, which I was actually a part of. And he then spilt the beans and started to tell us a lot more about the inside workings of the coup.
When Simon said that he had been, quote, a part of the interrogation, it made me wince. Because I've spent enough time in authoritarian countries, and I know that an interrogation of a suspected coup plotter could involve some really, really horrific things. So I pressed him on it.
There was no sort of fingernails being pulled out, but it wasn't pleasant at all, no.
Pleasant or not, for Simon, it worked. Simon got word that he was being pardoned.
Well, first of all, I didn't believe them. So they told me on a Saturday morning, so they said, you're going to get a pardon on Monday. And then they say, well, you don't look very pleased. And I said, well, I'll look very pleased when it happens.
Simon Mann is out of jail after being pardoned. The convicted coup plotter just needed to have some paperwork processed before regaining his freedom. He'd been found guilty of scheming to overthrow the government in Equatorial Guinea and sentenced to 34 years in prison.
And on the Monday, the pardon was announced. On the Tuesday, I got it. And on the Wednesday, I was landing in England. And it was the most extraordinary relief. Just absolutely amazing.
So I asked Simon, what did he do when he arrived back in the UK, after years of languishing in a prison cell in Zimbabwe and Equatorial Guinea?
I had to ring up my wife, Amanda. I rang her up, and I was fully expecting her to say, either then or later, I'm so glad you're out, but I've got to tell you, life's moved on, and I've met someone else. We're not together anymore. Anyway, I rang her up, and I was so nervous. It was like a sort of first date, and I was sweating. I thought, oh, my God, you know. And we started laughing on the phone. And I just thought, well, if we can laugh, there's hope. And when I got back, you know, we got it back together. And I think that was the most important thing by miles.
There are a lot of really disturbing ethical questions around what Simon planned to do and what he did in sub-Saharan Africa. His critics often use phrases like neo-colonialist or neo-imperialist. But when you zoom out and think about mercenaries as a whole, it is true that outsourcing military operations to mercenaries can bring some real strategic benefits. It can allow a government to operate in multiple theaters at one time, much more cheaply than it might otherwise. And if you want to read more about mercenaries in general, you can read Sarah Percy's book called Mercenaries, or P.W. Singer's book called Corporate Warriors. And if you want to read more about the Wanga coup, buy James's gripping book called My Friend the Mercenary, or buy Simon's book.
I have it, and it's, I think, now very, very cheap on Amazon.
But this entire story, the entire saga of the Wanga coup, is overshadowed by one very large moral elephant in the room. When it comes to Western mercenary armies, overthrowing regimes or fighting in civil wars, is it practical? Is it acceptable? And is it moral?
Is it really a viable solution to have unsupported coups by Westerners in every single dictatorship or slightly dodgy government in Africa? You'd have chaos.
That's Sarah Percy again. And she says that one of the big criticisms that mercenaries often face is that there simply aren't the mechanisms of oversight that normal armies have built in.
Because normal soldiers have evolved in Western democracies over centuries to have a very complicated system of oversight with the state. So our regular military is both in terms of legislation, but also in terms of norms and practices, very tightly entwined with the process of democracy. So we have a huge amount of oversight over our regular military. We have very good and very robust ways of controlling a military when they do things that are wrong. We have a very powerful history of civil military relations where coups in Western countries are almost unheard of. And the issue with private contractors is that none of that exists. And any of it that does, we've had to almost retrofit. It's like we have this second system of control, which relates to private contractors, when we, in fact, we had this very robust and very old system of control, which exists in relation to regular militaries.
Even Simon Mann, a man who made a fortune out of mercenary work, says he agrees with that criticism.
My personal view is that these things are much better done by government forces. I don't think it's the way to go. Because if you're wearing a cap badge of the British Army or you're an American soldier, at the end of the day, there's an audit trail of moral responsibility. And at the end of the day, you are the representative of a democratically elected government and you are doing things which your government has asked you to do. And they've been elected by the people of your country. And so there's an audit trail from the voter to the soldier. Even if he's 1,000 miles away on the other side of the world. A mercenary doesn't have that.
He also argues that the problem with mercenary forces is that when you bring profit into war, it causes you to cut corners.
So if I can give you an example, there we are in Sierra Leone, and there's a ferocious debate going on. Are we to have 3 helicopters or 2? Now, the guys are saying, listen, if we don't have 3 helicopters, then one of our guys is going to die.
But another helicopter is expensive.
Now, the cost of a 3rd helicopter is $2.5-3 million plus the running cost. And that is coming straight out of people's pockets. That's the profit. Now, the businessman says, well, I think we can get by on 2 or perhaps even 1. And the soldiers are saying, no, we need 3 or 4. And now those discussions are extremely difficult.
Beyond the financial squeeze that comes with being a for-profit fighting force, there are bigger issues at stake. Because there aren't that many laws that exist to regulate mercenary fighters. They operate in a bit of a gray zone. And even then, some mercenary armies don't operate within the law.
There's a white market and a black market for private security. And reputable private security firms are very clear to say that they're the white market, that they are reputable. And that what they do is they provide services and they do it for states and they do it in such a way that they're often helping states out where they otherwise wouldn't be able to proceed, and they often do quite good things. Whether or not you buy that, I think, is the first step, and there are a lot of people who would take issue with that. But the second step is that there is also a black market for private force. There are also people who will do anything, and they will join in any operation, and they will do it for the money. And the real issue is there's a huge amount of crossover and overlap between the black market and the white market. And when I was writing my book, I interviewed this guy. We were talking about this very problem. And he said, look, it was not entirely surprising to me when I turned on the television one night and saw the guys who were on my security detail in Iraq who were working for Blackwater in shackles on trial in Equatorial Guinea. So the difficulty you've got is that the same personnel will often shift back and forth between operations that we would maybe not have a huge problem with, like supporting U.S. forces in Iraq, with operations that we would, in fact, have a huge problem with, like running a coup in Equatorial Guinea. And the difficulty is that once you loosen all of those oversight mechanisms that I've talked about, the legislative mechanisms, the normative mechanisms, all of those things, then you've let the genie out of the bottle and it becomes much harder to contain the sorts of private force that we want to contain than it was previously.
And all of this boils down to a fundamental question: intent. Why was Simon trying to overthrow the government of Equatorial Guinea? What was it all for? And the first argument put forward is that it was to liberate the country from a terrible tyrant.
So it seems to me that actually regime change in Equatorial Guinea, it's very hard to imagine how you could get worse than Teodoro Obiang. I mean, you know, Idi Amin, maybe. ISIS. I mean, he's pretty there at the top of the table. His uncle, possibly worse, marginally.
But James says that wasn't the real reason. Would they have executed the coup plot for free? Of course not. But the coup plotters do often claim that they had real concern for the people of Equatorial Guinea.
The coup plotters used that as a justification, though cynically, because they were not interested in that at all. They were interested in the money, and whatever any of them tell you, I can tell you that from personal experience, that is false.
When I discussed other mercenary operations that Simon was involved with, he did often justify them in moral terms. And when I asked him whether he would do whatever job he was asked to do, so long as the payoff was high enough, he pushed back.
We did discuss it. I mean, you know, it wasn't like we just sort of thought, oh, well, here's a good project, let's just do it. We thought about it very long and hard.
But the thing is, it does seem pretty likely that it was really all about the money.
The idea, essentially, was that a group of businessmen, international businessmen, in Britain, America, and Spain, were going to use an exiled opposition leader to front a puppet government which would be supported by private military mercenary power, and that this new regime would divide up oil contracts and revenue between the coup backers, which would make them rich men, but that would also transform Equatorial Guinea, as one of the coup plotters put it to me, into the Switzerland of Africa. So the idea would be that they would use this oil revenue to create a very small, very rich, pro-Western corporation, almost. If you can imagine an oil-based Singapore in the Bight of Benin, I think that's what they were looking at. And if that's sounding to your listeners like an absolutely absurd idea from the get-go, they'd be right.
And as James explains, even if the plot had been carried out without a hitch, which is a big if, the idea was still flawed from the beginning, because you can't just topple a government and expect everyone to just immediately accept it.
And the first question to ask was just very simply, even if all of this succeeds, even if you manage to land your men, you marry them up with the weapons, you seize control, you get the president, you install the puppet, even if all of that happens, what do you think Nigeria is going to do? And no one could ever come up with a coherent answer to that, that somehow it would just all be all right.
And some of that hubris, in James's view at least, came from the notion that white men in Africa used to be able to get their way, and they didn't realize that the world has changed.
Now, I think at the root, the heart of the miscalculation was that, you know, and I don't want this to sound like sycophantically woke, or it's a group of old white blokes who'd been pretty successful in the 90s, just couldn't see that times had changed. That the security services in Angola, Equatorial Guinea, South Africa, Zimbabwe were just better than they were. And they assumed blithely that because white people in suits in London told them that everything was going to be okay, it would be.
And that's where James takes responsibility for his actions. For the hubris, the arrogance, the adventurism of people like Simon, who James argues were clearly in it for the money, and for people like James, who is at least partly in it for the adventure and the good footage.
But it seems to me a kind of remarkable act of arrogance to think that a group of rich white men felt that this was something they could do and profit from it, utterly, utterly divorced from the feelings of the tens of thousands of people who'd be subject to the changes that they wrought. And I lumped myself in with that. I don't know whether I would have gone ahead with it. Probably I would have done. And I would have been guilty of the same arrogance and adventurism that they were.
For his part, I asked Simon what he would say to, for example, someone who reads The Guardian and looks at his story and accuses him of being a neo-colonialist, a white man who wants to topple governments in Africa and set up puppet states for cash. And he rejected the notion outright, pointing to his career of mercenary work stretching across some of the poorest places on the planet, from Papua New Guinea to Angola to Sierra Leone and Equatorial Guinea.
I mean, I don't think that's neo-colonialism. We're not trying to take it over for anybody. The first two, we were trying to end the Civil War, which were horrible civil wars, as they always are, in fact. The third was to take back a bit of a country that had every right to take it back. And a coup against the tyrant, who were we neo-colonialising it for? It was going to be given back to the people it belongs to. So, to the Guardian reader, I say, look, I get it. It's okay, but I'm really not a neo-colonialist or anything like it.
I'll leave it to you to decide. Thanks for listening. Subscribe now, and if you like the show or learn something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And I'd really appreciate it if you'd be willing to post about Power Corrupts on your social media as well. We rely on word of mouth to get new listeners. Next episode, we've got a how-to guide for you. How to be a dictator. Should you be ruthless or respectful? We'll meet a Thai journalist who was kidnapped and given a bit of weird Stockholm syndrome by a military junta. We'll get tips from the author of The Dictator's Handbook. And we'll speak to a chess legend turned Putin opponent, Garry Kasparov.
It's a mafia state where, you know, loyalty to the boss means more than any belief in certain ideology.
Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Theme music by Scott Holmes. And a special thanks to Daniela Sims, who contributed significant research for this episode. Goodbye for now.